Chapter 61. Prongs of his fork, as from her own. On going up to the fire, to throw a pitch of dead weeds upon it, she found that he did the same on the other side. The fire flared up, and she beheld the face of D'Urberville. The unexpectedness of his presence, the grotesqueness of his appearance in a gathered smock frock, such as was now worn only by the most old-fashioned of the laborers, had a ghastly comicality that chilled her as to its bearing. D'Urberville emitted a low, long laugh. "If I were inclined to joke, I should say, how much this seems like paradise," he remarked whimsically, looking at her with an inclined head. "What do you say?" she weakly asked. "A jester might say this is just like paradise. You are Eve, and I am the old other one come to tempt you in the disguise of an inferior animal. I used to be quite up in that scene of Milton's when I was theological. Some of it goes, press, the way is ready, and not long, beyond a row of myrtles. If thou accept my conduct, I can bring thee thither soon. Eat then," said Eve. And so on. "My dear Tess, I am only putting this to you as a thing that you might have supposed or said quite untruly, because you think so badly of me. I never said you were Satan, or thought it. I don't think of you in that way at all. My thoughts of you are quite cold, except when you affront me. What, did you come digging here entirely because of me?" "Entirely. To see you, nothing more. The smock frock, which I saw hanging for sale as I came along, was an afterthought, that I mightn't be noticed. I come to protest against your working like this. But I like doing it as for my father." "Your engagement at the other place is ended?" "Yes." "Where are you going to next?" "To join your dear husband?" She could not bear the humiliating reminder. "Oh, I don't know," she said bitterly. "Have no husband. It is quite true in the sense you mean. But you have a friend, and I have determined that you shall be comfortable and sweet of yourself. When you get down to your house, you will see what I have sent there for you. Oh, Alec, I wish you wouldn't give me anything at all. I cannot take it from you. I don't like it is not right." "It is right," he cried lightly. "I'm not going to see a woman whom I feel so tenderly for as I do for you, in trouble without trying to help her. But I am very well off. I am only in trouble about, not about living at all." She turned, and desperately resumed her digging, tears dripping upon the fork handle, and upon the cloths. "About the children, your brothers and sisters," he resumed. I've been thinking of them." Tess's heart quivered. He was touching her in a weak place. He had divined her chief anxiety. Since returning home, her soul had gone out to those children with an affection that was passionate. "If your mother does not recover, somebody ought to do something for them, since your father will not be able to do much, I suppose?" "He can with my assistance." "He must." "And with mine?"
"No, sir."
"H, how damn foolish this is," burst out D'Urberville. "Hi, he thinks we are the same family, and will be quite satisfied."
"He don't. I've undeceived him."
"The more fool you." D'Urberville in anger retreated from her to the hedge, where he pulled off the long smock frock which had disguised him, and rolling it up and pushing it into the couch fire, went away. Tess could not get on with her digging after this. She felt restless. She wondered if he had gone back to her father's house, and taking the fork in her hand proceeded homewards. Some 20 yards from the house she was met by one of her sisters.
"Oh, Tessie, what do you think? Liza Lou is a crying, and there's a lot of folk in the house, and mother is a good deal better, but they think father is dead."
The child realized the grandeur of the news, but not as yet its sadness, and stood looking at Tess with round-eyed importance, till, beholding the effect produced upon her, she said, "What, Tess, shan't we talk to father never no more?" "But father was only a little bit ill," exclaimed Tess distractedly. Liza Lou came up. "He dropped down just now, and the doctor who was there for mother said there was no chance for him, because his heart was growed in."
"Yes, The Derbyfield couple had changed places. The dying one was out of danger, and the indisposed one was dead. The news meant even more than it sounded. Her father's life had a value apart from his personal achievements, or perhaps it would not have had much. It was the last of the three lives for whose duration the house and premises were held under a lease, and it had long been coveted by the tenant farmer for his regular laborers, who were stinted in cottage accommodation. Moreover, Liviers were disapproved of in villages almost as much as little freeholders, because of their independence of manner, and when the lease determined it was never renewed. Thus the Derbyfields, once D'Urbervilles, saw descending upon them the destiny which, no doubt, when they were among the Olympians of the county, they had caused to descend many a time, and severely enough, upon the heads of such landless ones as they themselves were not. So do flux and reflux, the rhythm of change, alternate and persist in everything under the sky. Lee, at length it was the eve of Old Lady Day, and the agricultural world was in a fever of mobility such as only occurs at that particular date of the year. It is a day of fulfillment. Agreements for outdoor service during the ensuing year, entered into at Candlemas, are to be now carried out. The laborers, or orc folk, as they used to call themselves immemorially till the other word was introduced from without, who wish to remain no longer in old places, are removing to the new farms. These annual migrations from farm to farm were on the increase here. When Tess's mother was a child, the majority of the field folk about Marlott had remained all their lives on one farm, which had been the home also of their fathers and grandfathers. But latterly the desire for yearly removal had risen to a high pitch. With the younger families it was a pleasant excitement which might possibly be an advantage. The Egypt of one family was the land of promise to the family who saw it from a distance, till by residence there it became a turn their Egypt also, and so they changed and changed. However, all the mutations so increasingly discernible in village life did not originate entirely in the agricultural unrest. A depopulation was also going on. The village had formerly contained, side by side with the agricultural laborers, an interesting and better informed class, ranking distinctly above the former the class to which Tess's father and mother had belonged, and including the carpenter, the smith, the shoemaker, the huckster, together with nondescript workers other than farm laborers, a set of people who owed a certain stability of aim and conduct to the fact of their being lifeholders like Tess's father, or copyholders, or occasionally, small freeholders. But as the long holdings fell in, they were seldom again let to similar tenants, and were mostly pulled down, if not absolutely required by the farmer for his hands. Cottagers who were not directly employed on the land were looked upon with disfavor, and the banishment of some starved the trade of others, who were thus obliged to follow. These families, who had formed the backbone of the village life in the past, who were the depositaries of the village traditions, had to seek refuge in the large centers. The process, humorously designated by statisticians as the tendency of the rural population towards the large towns, being really the tendency of water to flow uphill when forced by machinery. The cottage accommodation at Marlott, having been in this manner considerably curtailed by demolitions, every house which remained standing was required by the agriculturist for his workpeople. Ever since the occurrence of the event which had cast such a shadow over Tess's life, the Derbyfield family, whose descent was not credited, had been tacitly looked on as one which would have to go when their lease ended, if only in the interests of morality. It was, indeed, quite true that the household had not been shining examples either of temperance, soberness, or chastity. The father, and even the mother, had got drunk at times, the younger children seldom had gone to church, and the eldest daughter had made queer unions. By some means the village had to be kept pure. So on this, the first Lady Day on which the Derbyfields were expellable, the house, being roomy, was required for a carter with a large family, and Widow Joan, her daughters Tess and Liza Lou, the boy Abraham and the younger children, had to go elsewhere. On the evening preceding their removal, it was getting dark bedtimes by reason of a drizzling rain which blurred the sky. As it was the last night they would spend in the village which had been their home and birthplace, Mrs. Derbyfield, Liza Lou, and Abraham had gone out to bid some friends goodbye, and Tess was keeping house till they should return. She was kneeling in the window bench, her face close to the casement, where an outer pane of rainwater was sliding down the inner pane of glass. Her eyes rested on the web of a spider, probably starved long ago, which had been mistakenly placed in a corner, where no flies ever came, and shivered in the slight draft through the casement. Tess was reflecting on the position of the household, in which she perceived her own evil influence. Had she not come home, her mother and the children might probably have been allowed to stay on as weekly tenants. But as he had been observed almost immediately on her return by some people of scrupulous character and great influence, they had seen her idling in the churchyard, restoring as well as she could with a little trowel a baby's obliterated grave. By this means they had found that she was living here again. Her mother was scolded for harboring her. Sharp retorts had ensued from Joan, who had independently offered to leave at once, as he had been taken at her word. And here was the result. "I ought never to have come home," said Tess to herself, bitterly. She was so intent upon these thoughts that she hardly at first took note of a man in a white Macintosh whom she saw riding down the street. Possibly it was owing to her face being near to the pane that he saw her so quickly and directed his horse so close to the cottage front that his hoofs were almost upon the narrow border for plants growing under the wall. It was not till he touched the window with his riding crop that she observed him. The rain had nearly ceased, and she opened the casement in obedience to his gesture. "Didn't you see me?" asked D'Urberville. "I was not attending," she said. "Heard you, I believe, though I fancied it was a carriage and horses. I was in a sort of dream." "Ah, you heard the D'Urberville coach, perhaps. You know the legend, I suppose?" "No. My somebody was going to tell it me once, but didn't." "If you are a genuine D'Urberville, I ought not to tell you either, I suppose. As for me, I'm a sham one, so it doesn't matter. It is rather dismal. It is that the sound of a non-existent coach can only be heard by one of D'Urberville blood, and it is held to be of ill omen to the one who hears it. It has to do with a murder committed by one of the family centuries ago. Now you have begun it, finish it." "Very well. One of the family is said to have abducted." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.